Good morning. Welcome to Prairie Unitarian Universalist Society. We strive to be a welcoming congregation. We welcome you no matter your ethnicity, no matter your family structure, no matter your sexual orientation, your gender, the color of your hair, your physical ability, or your lack of hair, your physical abilities, or your physical inabilities. And we like to hope, no matter your political persuasion, though we don't get into that on Sunday mornings. If this is your first time here, or one of your first times, I encourage you to come more than once because our services are very different on different Sunday mornings. Sometimes I do the service. I am Sandy Ingham, Prairie's minister. Sometimes people from within the congregation do the service, which is the case today. Professor Matt Tedesco will do the service. Sometimes people from outside the congregation do our services. Also, if you are new or visiting and you'd like to introduce yourself, we don't force you to do that. We just stare at you until you do it. No, we won't do that. But there will be a time for that a little. There'll be time for that later on in the service. Let's officially begin then with these opening words from Deuteronomy. If there is among you anyone in need, a member of your community in any of your towns, do not be hard-hearted or tight-fisted towards your needy neighbor. You should rather open your hand, willingly lending enough to meet the need, whatever it may be. Faith, would you please light the chalice? You are welcome here, visitor, friend, or longtime member. You are welcome here with your family or partner or lover or alone. We joyfully welcome you here. You are welcome here as believer or doubter, as joiner or loner. You are welcome here, feeling a part of us or not, full of energy or plain tired, seeking a vision or a rest. You are welcome to join us as you are. Written by a minister I know, Ray Drennan. As always, it is a delight and a pleasure to introduce today's speaker, who's sort of become a regular on our lecture circuit. But I should speak slowly because we're having technical difficulties. Okay. Matt Tedesco, who is a member of Prairie, is doing, I've lost track of how many great services he's done. Three or four, I said, you're becoming a regular. And he and I decided he doesn't need any introduction. But anything you want to say, well, you could say where you teach if you want to. Say whatever you want. Yeah. It's all yours.
All right, great. I'll just say briefly where I do teach, I suppose. So I'm a professor of philosophy at Beloit College, for those of you who don't know. I've given, this will be, I guess, my fourth service here. When Penny approached me a few months ago, she was putting together the calendar of sort of services for, you know, the foreseeable future, and asked if I had anything that I want to present on or talk about. I answered yes. But at the time, it wasn't with any clear idea of what that would be. I thought, well, you know, I'm always, as I'm thinking about stuff that I'm teaching or reading, I sometimes come across things and think, well, that would be a fun one to share with the community here. So I didn't have anything in particular in mind. Go to the first slide. Go back one now. Yeah, there, that one. If you were at the November 8th service, this may ring a bell. If not, don't worry about it, because I've just recaptured what was relevant from that service. That was, if you remember, going back 4 weeks, I thought a really interesting and excellent service on the UU Service Committee and the good work that they've been doing and how they've been doing it. And I thought it was fascinating in lots of ways. But what was what caught my eye was the closing words from that service. And so I kept the bulletin so that I could reproduce them exactly to kind of start today. So there's a way in which what I'm talking about today is in some ways just directly continuous with that conversation. And so my hope is that this will be in some ways interesting in a kind of, in a way that represents that continuity. I also recognize, I want to put this on the table right at the top, what I thought would be interesting to talk about today is something you may have come across in one way or another in some place. I kicked over someone's water. I didn't realize there was water there, sorry. At any rate, you may have come across this because it's a relatively famous argument. But at any rate, I thought it'd be fun to talk about it. So if you've come across it before, think of this as sort of a refresher, and it's a good thing to be refreshed upon. So the quote is from Peter Singer. Just as a quick sort of show of hands, how many of you are familiar with that name? Okay, so 2, 4, 6, okay, so about 8 or 10 people. That's good. So that's actually fewer than I thought, but that's fine. Because in some ways, thanks very much for doing that, Karen. I apologize. So this is the quote from the end of that service. I'll just read it. The failure of people in their rich nations to make any significant sacrifices in order to assist people who are dying from poverty-related causes is ethically indefensible. It is not simply the absence of charity, let alone of moral saintliness. It is wrong, and one cannot claim to be a morally decent person unless one is doing far more than the typically comfortably off person does. And this is from something you said in 2002. And so, those are the closing words. You know, as sometimes happens, you know, they were read and a few people went, oh, you know, you sort of have that, okay, that's kind of a strong claim. Because it is, if you look at it closely just for a second, it's a really strong claim. And it might be one that you agree with, or it might be one that you disagree with, but something that struck me that day is that you ought to see, if you don't already, you may, that this is not merely a claim. It's a conclusion to an argument. And in fact, it's a conclusion to a relatively famous argument that he offered a long time before that. Oh, you went ahead one. Yeah, fair enough. Yeah, so, wow, nice work. What I thought would be a kind of a fun thing to do, you know, fun, you've got to think of that in a somewhat wide way. Yeah, what I thought would be fun would be to share with you that argument. Yeah.
Imagine if you'd be up on the platform, those of us in the back could see you.
Oh, sure, yeah. You know what the problem is? There's a reason I can't, and it's that I need to be able to see the screen. Because I actually don't have a copy of the slide, so I'll try to. If we were to move that back, I think we would lose it completely. It took us about 10 minutes of adjusting to make it happen. So I'm sort of open to that. I could sort of do that, and then maybe I'm sort of halfway up on the platform, and you can see me a little bit better. Part of the problem too is I sort of move around a lot, so maybe I'll sort of orbit the lectern, and we'll see if that works. Kick over some more water. So what I thought I would do today is share with you that argument that at the very least I think is challenging and provoking and compelling, and kind of go through exactly how it works and why Singer thinks that claim, that very strong claim that concluded the service 4 weeks ago, isn't just something we can sort of like or not like, but if we want to reject it, we have to do it by going into the argument and figuring out where it goes wrong. And it's from, by the way, I'll reference it once or twice, it's from a paper that goes back quite a long ways, relatively speaking anyway, to 1972, a paper called Famine, Affluence, and Morality. Go to the next slide if you would. So there's Peter Singer, there he is. Actually, kind of a fun aside about Peter Singer. I've sort of bothered this guy a few times over the last 5 or 6 years, trying to get him to come to Beloit College to give a talk. And for what it's worth, I couldn't get him to come for a couple of reasons. But one of which was that he's really, really, really expensive. But what's fascinating? So he gave me the
the price of what it would cost to come to the Midwest for a couple of days. But he said, but, you know, don't worry, I give 100% of it away. So anyway, a little bit, you'll hear about the guy as we go along too. He's sort of an interesting character. And by the way, I should also mention, because I'll forget you later, Robin Proud mentioned this just this morning in the New York Times. There's an article on effective altruism. That's a movement you may have heard of that he's connected with too. And so I think he comes up in that article as well. Anyway, here's what he says in that article from 1972. This is in the introduction to the article. It says, in what follows, I shall argue that the way people in relatively affluent countries, right, read ours, among others, react to a situation like that in Bengal cannot be justified. Indeed, the whole way we look at moral issues, our moral conceptual scheme, needs to be altered, and with it, the way of life that has come to be taken for granted in our society. Two things to say about this. The first is, just by way of context, he happened to be writing at a time where in East Bengal there was sort of a terrible famine that ended up costing just a huge number of lives. And so this, my understanding is anyway, there was quite a lot of attention paid in a variety of ways to this, and so he's responding to this paper sort of meant as a response to that, going back, 43 years. But then the other thing is, I mean, note the ambition, right? This is a paper with a pretty lofty goal, right? That is to change fundamentally the way we understand our moral situation in the world. That is, who we are and what we owe to others. And so if his argument is successful, it's meant to shift our understanding of that moral situation. And so make that, so closing words from 4 weeks ago, something that we're sort of forced to accept, whether we want to or not. So go to the next slide. I worried this was sort of too pedantic, but I'll move very quickly through this. But I thought it'd be worth just saying this is sort of a brief snapshot of sort of baby logic. But just worth saying when I use the word argument today. I'm using it not in a kind of ordinary sense of like disagreement, you know, you think one thing, I think another, and now we think less of each other for it or whatever. But rather, I'm using it in a slightly more technical term, right? So an argument is a set of sentences, one of which is taken to be supported by the rest, right? So we call the supporting sentences, the premises, the one that's being supported, the conclusion. But recognize, the thing to take away from this is that, you know, conclusions are interesting to arguments. You know, so if I come along and I say, you know, abortion is immoral, I mean, that's sort of a sexy thing to say in terms of to catch your attention, but what's interesting is the argument that supports that claim, right? I mean, you know, there's a way in which if you disagree with me, what's not interesting is disagree with the conclusion. It's showing how somewhere in my reasoning I've gone wrong. And so that's, I guess, the only thing I really want to emphasize about arguments today. So, you know, well, you know, mad as a man, all men are mortal, therefore mad is sort of a famous, well, sort of twisting of a famous example of an argument. So, you know, I can look at this and think, you know, gosh darn it, you know, I'm immortal. But, you know, if I take the two sentences to be true, that is, I'm a man and all men are mortal, I'm sort of forced to accept my own mortality as sort of daunting as that might be. That's a topic for another talk. You can stroll. I don't know if this is too interesting. Maybe we could just skip this one entirely. This is just to say, you know, the evaluation of arguments is actually this sort of beautiful and elegant thing, which is, as you look at an argument, you sort of figure out what the premises are, you know, there's just a limited number of ways to show that an argument goes wrong. Right, that is, either the premises are true or false, or else they fail to support the conclusion in the way that you take it to when you're offering the argument. So there's a limited number of ways to attack any argument, though the permutations kind of scatter from there. But I don't think we need to talk about that, so we can move along. I wanna say something more about. Go back. Thank you. Yeah. So I know it's a hair trigger. Yeah. Fair enough. So here's just a general kind of mapping of the sort of the landscape of morality. I think this is just a general way to think of, I mean, one way to think about morality is sort of dividing up the universe of actions between those that are morally permissible and those that are morally impermissible. And of course, you can make distinctions in each of those categories. And I guess I'll just say, at least in a preliminary way, that you can think of every action as falling into one of those two categories, you know? So, you know, I flossed my teeth last night. I remember I was talking about this, a month ago, right? Is it good for the teeth? Is it good for the gums? Whatever. The point is, right? Look, flossing your teeth, morally permissible. You know, committing genocide, morally impermissible, right? And so you can sort of think, right, as you think about everything you could possibly be doing this afternoon, those two being one of many, two of many choices, that they all sort of fall into those categories, one way or the other. Now, but you can make further sub-distinctions, obviously, within each of those categories. And so I'll just sort of highlight here, as you're sort of dividing up the universe of morally permissible actions, while there's sort of further categories. I think this is a sort of an important feature, sort of understanding Singer's argument, and how it may be a challenge, even if you find parts of it resonating with you or you feel sympathetic towards parts of it. And it's this. We can distinguish among some morally permissible actions between those that are morally required and those that are supererogatory or sort of beyond duty, right? So where I take supererogatory, this is sort of like, it's a clunky word, but it's meant to pick out those actions that it would be permissible not to do. But, you know, if you were to do them, we think that there's something sort of extra good about that, right? We admire you for it, or we think you've done sort of like a moral, you've sort of earned a moral gold star or something like that, right? So, you know, if you hadn't done it, you know, here's the key, right? We wouldn't blame you for not doing it, right? We wouldn't think that you've done something wrong. But when you do it, we say, that was a good thing to do. That was a nice thing to do. We admire that. Whereas I take it that morally required actions are those that I sort of have to do, right? That sort of morality demands it of me. If I don't do it, you know, I've done something immoral, right? So, I don't know, you know, if, you know, back when my kids were little, you know, it's probably still true now, right? But especially when they were like really small, if I just sort of said, this football game's really good. I know that they probably haven't eaten in, you know, 18 hours or so, but presumably, you know, the fact that I'm failing to feed them is morally impermissible, right? That I'm blameworthy for not doing it, right? That sort of, it's sort of required of me that I do that. And so I sort of make this distinction up front just to say that it's, I think basically the way to understand what Singer's trying to do when he's helping us or trying to help us think about what it is that we owe to others. I sort of titled this talk The Ethics of Assistance, right? Because there's a way in which it's framed around a kind of question that bubbles up more or less somewhat frequently, I think, when we're paying attention to the world around us or things that are happening. So you think about things like, you know, like the Syrian refugee crisis or whatever, right? And so these moments come up where you look and you say, wow, you know, there are people who are in real need. Here's what I know about this community, especially, that this is something that is high on many of your radars, you know, more than maybe, you know, many others. Right? So anyway, the idea is, you know, this is something we're aware of, but the question is, when we are one way or another rendering assistance, and that could take the form of actually physically engaging with people who are in need, so physically going into the community or reaching out with your skills, talents, energies, abilities to help people. I think in many other forms, it involves providing financial support to organizations and people who are well-positioned to deliver aid, assistance to those who need it. Whether or not this is something that you're deeply committed to, I think probably most people here are to some level or other, it's still, I think, somewhat of a potentially shocking idea to think that that's not in 1B. That is, the helping of others isn't something that is sort of above and beyond the call of duty. Right? That is, it's something that is morally required of us. That failing to do it makes us blameworthy. And now, you know, this, I'm saying things that are maybe a little bit too broad, but you know, it's potentially the sort of thing that actually makes us a bad person. You know, makes us having done something wrong. And so there's a challenge built into that sort of a claim that we saw a while ago that I want to unpack the argument for and leave enough time for discussion. One nice thing about this is I think this will be a fun one to chat about. So the table's been set. So what's the argument? Yeah, go ahead, flip ahead. So look, the argument itself is in some ways, as he lays it out in that paper anyway, Famine, Affluence, and Morality, it's pretty simple, I think. Pretty straightforward, maybe. So here's the first premise. Suffering and death from lack of food, shelter, and medical care are bad. Pretty hard to disagree with. Now, here's one thing he says. I put the quote up there, too. I think one useful feature of this paper, I think it's a good feature of good, at least good philosophical writing anyway, is that you are aware of the places where you're just simply saying, I'm not going any deeper than this, right? It's possible. It's more than just possible. I think there are potentially ways where you might want to say, okay, let's dig deeper. Is that really true? Why is it true? What are the moral foundations of this kind of a claim? And there could be potentially quite a lot to say there. But, you know, from Singer's standpoint, right, this claim, which I find uncontroversial, is one that he thinks most of us will find uncontroversial. And so he says, look, that is essentially the starting point of the paper. If you disagree with this, you know, you don't need to read any further. And so, you know, what I would suggest is, you know, don't just walk out if you disagree. But, you know, I do think, you know, this is one place where it's kind of hard to put, you have to have a pretty unorthodox moral view of the world to disagree with this. So I'm willing to go with Singer on this. If you want, we can talk about this later, but I don't have much more to say about it. Go to the next one. Here's where things get exciting. And this is a clunky slide. I'm not really good with slides. I'll say, by the way, I don't usually use PowerPoint when I talk about stuff in classes or whatever. You know, one beautiful thing about teaching at Beloit College is it's much more of a, you know, the classes are small and you know, we have much more of a conversation. So anyway, so here's a principle that's really important to pay attention to the wording on, because it's doing the justificatory work in this paper, right? This is the place where, you know, once you sort of buy into this, right, you're kind of going to get stuck, potentially anyway, you know, buying into a conclusion, right? And so he's offering, you know, he actually doesn't actually give it a name. I'll give it this name because it sort of captures the wording he uses in the paper. The principle of preventing bad occurrences. And he does give two versions of the paper, and I want to just take a moment to be clear about both of these, because they're really important. They're really important not just for the paper, but I think they're really important for reflecting on how it is, morally speaking, we understand what we do and how we do it and why. And so let me go there. So the moderate version, this is the one he starts with. So let me just read it and then just say a few things about it. If it's in our power to prevent something bad from happening, without thereby sacrificing anything of comparable moral importance, we ought morally to do it. Now, yeah, you think about it for a second, you're like, makes sense, I guess. You know, compared to something bad, we're not sacrificing something as bad, we should do it. Now, when you start to think about how this might work, though, I mean, it's a pretty demanding principle. It's a pretty demanding principle. So, I mean, well, why? You know, I mean, you know, you can use thought experiments to tease out why. Well, let me offer one. This is maybe not a good one, but it's just the one that's occurring to me now. So look, imagine, this is very science fictional, but whatever, right? So imagine that there's sort of someone on on a sort of a train track. Maybe they're, you know, they've been, I don't know, hypnotized, or they're sort of tied down or whatever. And you see the train speeding towards them, and you're like the world's greatest physicist, right? So you can like do the instant calculations, and you recognize running at full speed and diving to knock this person out of the way, right? You'll be able to do it, but you know, the train will like clip your foot in a way that will cost you your pinky toe. But if you don't do it, there's no one else, train can't stop, person's gonna be obliterated. You know, should you do it? Probably, okay, pinky toe's not that bad, this person's gonna die. But then you start, you know, now you're the world's greatest physicist, right? So now just start kind of cranking up, you know, the angle that the train's hitting your body, right? So now it costs you your foot, or your leg below the knee, or both your legs. Or, I mean, at a certain, now recognize, you know, what's the trade-off here, right? You're preventing something bad, that is someone from dying, from getting sort of obliterated by this train. So what's of comparable moral importance to that? Well, potentially pretty high. And so just, I mean, recognize, he calls this the modern version of the principle. That's pretty high up the sort of high scale from you know, weak to strong. So, but anyway, take that one and kind of put it aside, but don't forget it. Because part of what this paper is meant to do, it's sort of meant to force you back to thinking that that's probably right. Okay? And so he kind of offers this. He says, he doesn't hide his intentions. He says, look, I think this is true. I think there's good reasons to think this is true. But to get you to change your fundamental moral views about assistance, helping others, I don't need that principle. Instead, I need the weak version of that principle. Now, the weak version only makes two tweaks. All you got to do, I use bold for this so you can see it, right? Pull out bad and plug in very bad. Pull out comparable moral importance, plug in morally significant. So, if it is in our power to prevent something very bad from happening, without thereby sacrificing anything morally significant, we ought morally to do it. Well, this is much different, right? If you're the genius physicist looking at the train track, right, what's a morally significant? I mean, you know, this is essentially saying, right? Give when you can prevent something very bad. What kinds of things are very bad? Go back to that starting assumption. Things like suffering and death from lack of food, medical care, etc. Right? If you can do that while only sacrificing something that from the moral point of view is trivial, we're not talking, you know, both legs below the knees here. We're talking about something that essentially doesn't matter at all. Right? Then surely, morality doesn't just admire you for doing that. You're required to do it. Not doing it, right, is having done something wrong. And so even if, you know, so I asked before, and like 9 or 10 raised their hands when they said they've heard of Singer, and that may have been in a different context too. He's famous for other arguments as well. Go to the next slide. I think I put it here. Good. All right. Images, whatever. All right. So even if you haven't heard of Singer, right, You may have heard of sort of the famous case he offers in this paper. And here's where he offers it. All right, here's the quote. An application of this principle, that is the weak version of the principle of preventing bad occurrences, right, is as follows. If I'm walking past a shallow pond and see a child drowning in it, I ought to wade in and pull the child out. This will mean getting my clothes muddy, but this is insignificant, while the death of the child would presumably be a very bad thing. Think of this. We didn't have a story for all ages today. So you could pretty easily sort of turn this into a story for all ages, right? So there you are, walking along, and you happen to pass by a shallow pond, right? And, you know, you happen to see, you know, sort of a small child kind of very clearly in distress. floating, you know, sort of, you know, kind of, you know, moving around, maybe face down, frantically flopping about. And you know, here's what you know. Maybe you're on your way, you know, I was going to say an important job interview. Even that, you might think is morally significant. I don't know, depending on your circumstances. But look, you know, you know, going into the pond, you just got these new shoes, and the water is going to make them, you know, going to kind of ruin them. And maybe the shoes cost you like, you know, $50. Now look, $50 sacrifice isn't, you know, it's not literally nothing, but morally speaking, right, it seems pretty darn insignificant. And so, that's the trade-off he's asking you to imagine in this case. He's going to want to get a lot of mileage out of this case. He's going to use this case as an analogy kind of throughout the rest of the paper. And it gets used a lot in subsequent writings from him and others. It's probably one of, you know, take this with a grain of salt. It's probably one of the most famous thought experiments in philosophy in the last, I don't know, you know, 50 years or so. And so look, here's the claim. Well, actually, go to the next slide. I think I say something about it there. Yeah. Look, given the starting assumption, which seems pretty uncontroversial, I find it uncontroversial, right? Suffering and death from easily preventable means are bad things, right? Well, saving the child in the pond is not just supererogatory, not just good to do, but morally permissible not to do. If I came and I said to you, well, I was going to save the kid, but didn't want my shoes to get muddy, so I chose not to today, right? You know, if that's how the story for all ages ended, it'd be a bad story. You know, lots of kids angry at Sandy for having read it, right? Yeah. Or maybe parents, you know. Now I've got to deal with my kid asking about this, right? Yeah, so look, it's morally required to save the child in the pond, right? If you were to have been in that situation, right, you would have had to have saved the child. Right? Granted, we may still say, good job, great work, but if you didn't do it, we would say, I can't believe you didn't do that. Right? You did something wrong by walking by that child. And that's the key, right? That's the key for Singer's argument, because now you can start to see, once you've got the pieces in place, right, when you've got the assumption, you've got the principle, think of this case as in a way, I think, a kind of, not just, he calls it a kind of application of the principle, but it's meant to be, because he's going to use it throughout the paper, a kind of defense of the principle, right? The idea is, well, look, think about the shallow pond case. Our intuitions on this are really rock solid. We don't think about it and think, well, I don't know, should I save the kid or not, right? It's really straightforward. We should save the kid. And that he takes to be a kind of strong confirmation that principle is really getting at something, preventing very bad things, right, with only trivial sacrifices. Can't remember what's next, but go next and we'll see. Excited. Oh, yeah. Look, back to the, I thought it'd be good again to kind of call those closing words back again. There they are, just from the slide earlier, from the piece of paper that we had 4 weeks ago. Right? The failure of rich people in the rich, nations to make any significant sacrifices in order to assist people who are dying from poverty-related causes is ethically indefensible. Right? Why? They're dying! We know that's very bad. Right? Poverty-related causes, well, we know those are addressable insofar as many of us have a surplus of resources that we can send to people who can help. It's not simply the absence of charity, let alone of moral saintliness. It is wrong, and one can't claim to be a morally decent person unless one is doing far more than the typically comfortably off person does. And again, you know, think about that last bit, the typically comfortably off person does. If we're just utilizing that weaker principle of the preventing, the weaker version of the principle of preventing bad occurrences, right? Here's a question I take it Singer's inviting each of us to ask. At what point would a sacrifice become non-trivial? Because presumably that's going to be very different for each person, right? Depending on your material circumstances and your income and whatnot, right? So, you know, at what point for one person, you know, giving $20 to Oxfam might be really significant, right? For others, many others, it wouldn't be. And so there, what's the threshold, right? And so, you know, now you can do this game that Singer doesn't do in this paper, but he does it elsewhere, right? He sort of invites you to do. Think about the things you spend money on, right? If you had not spent that money on that, but instead sent it to provide mosquito nets to children who are in danger of life-threatening diseases in places where mosquito nets could prevent them, or sending them to a place where, you know, they provide oral rehydration to therapy to children who are, you know, in danger of dehydration or whatever. I mean, you know, at what point, you know, that dinner with friends, that trip to the movies, right, that, you know, just picking out the things you spend money on. And now Singer says, if you had foregone that, would you have foregone something morally important? It's not about not feeding your kids or whatever, right? But at what point does the sacrifice become non-trivial? Okay, now, good. Okay, so look, now, you know, having said all of that, right, I think even if, you know, whether you sort of are inclined to agree with Singer or not, I think it's worth kind of scanning the universe of possible objections, start to think, how do you push back against this? I mean, maybe you don't want to, maybe you do, I don't know, but I think this is sort of a good exercise anyway. Try to think about what are the possible ways in which you might find some flaws in this argument. Now, there's a range of possibilities. I'll just say, you're right at the top, you know, one possibility is to reject the starting assumption. Right, so you sort of say, well, no, I just don't agree that those things are bad, right? You know, lots of people dying of famine. Now, look, it's possible, but very few people sort of take that line, at least that's sort of I see in people who sort of are interested in criticizing this argument. But you could. Another way to go is to try to reject the weak version of the principle of preventing bad occurrences, right? So you want to say, okay, you know, I get the principle, just to remind you again, right? If it's in our power to prevent something very bad from happening without thereby sacrificing anything morally significant, I ought to do it. Well, the challenge with trying to reject that principle wholesale is, at the very least, it seems like, and we can talk about this more if you want, if it seems like it at least gets some cases right, like the shallow pond case. That is, if you were to imagine me to have shown up telling you the story, I walked by that kid in the pond, I decided not to, I didn't want to be late for service because it distracts people, or whatever, right? Now, if I had done that, I take it you would have been pretty harsh, but I think you also probably would have been harsh for at least roughly the reasons that that principle seems to pick out. That is, oh my gosh, this kid is drowning, and that's terrible. And you showing up late, that's all it would have cost. Who cares, right? So I mean, those are the kinds of considerations the principle is meant to pick out. So rejecting that wholesale, it's possible. Again, I'm open to entertaining that, but hard, at least on the face of it. But a third way to go is to say, hold on a minute. You know, maybe Singer's right about the assumption, and he's right about the principle, but there's something about cases like, well, the ones he's trying to reach to, right? Because go back, if you remember the kind of the start of the paper, he's thinking about a famine in a place that most of us are quite far from, have never been to, will never be near, involving people we've never met, have never engaged with, have never seen, right? And so what he's trying to do is motivate people like those in that kind of situation, you know, like me, for example, right, who has never been to that part of the world, to say, okay, you know what? I have a moral responsibility to contribute to those organizations that are directly kind of on the ground making a difference in saving people's lives and preventing very bad things from happening. Yes. Right? That's ultimately what he's aiming at here, right? And so the question is Singer's kind of move here of saying, in just the same way that principle applies to the shallow pond, it also applies to those kinds of cases. Is he overreaching somehow? Is there some relevant, maybe I go to the next slide, I think I say this here. Yeah, so here's the strategy, right? You want to, at least the one that I think most people are immediately inclined to take, right? You agree with the assumption, you agree with the weak principle of preventing bad occurrences, and agree that it applies in cases like the shallow pond, but you try to show that supporting aid organizations in the way I'm just describing, right, by providing them financial support so they can continue doing the work that they do. And by the way, just kind of put this on the table, you know, let's just take for, kind of assume for the sake of being charitable, that we're talking about, you know, reputable aid organizations whose work has been documented, right? So, you know, it's not like, you know, Discount Bob's Charity Shack or whatever, right? That we're talking about. We're talking about organizations whose accounting is, you know, public and has been, Charity Watch and Charity Navigator have, so we're talking reputable organizations here. And so we potentially, anyway, the response to try to show that supporting those organizations somehow is relevantly disanalogous from the case that Singer is trying to draw an analogy to here. Because he wants you to think, right? He wants you to find compelling the analogy that giving to those organizations is in the relevant ways, that is, the morally relevant ways, like pulling that kid out of the pond. Okay, so how might that go? I'm going to sketch a few possible responses, then I'll stop, because I want to make sure we have time to chat about this. So here's a few that sometimes come up, and Singer talks about some of them in his paper. So, here's one obvious difference, anyway, right? When I'm walking by the pond, I'm walking by a kid who's like, not far from me, a few feet from me, I can see him, I can hear him, it's very vivid, he's right there. When we're talking about things like, refugee crises or famines or whatever, typically, they're not quite as close to me. Typically, they're quite far from me. Now, Singer's response here, I think is interesting. I sort of use an exclamation point to mark that off. I think it's interesting because it's probably way more compelling her response now than it was in 1972. That is, his point is, I'll read the quote, "Unfortunately, for those who like to keep their moral responsibilities limited, instant communication and swift transportation have changed the situation," right? And this is obviously the time before the internet, right? And so this is probably even more compelling a claim now than it would have been in 1972. And so Singer's point is, look, this is, right, this sort of response is a psychological explanation for why, you see the kid, you can't help but kind of instantly be kind of trapped in, this is so vivid. When it's far from you, right? You see it on the news, you read it in the story, but then it's sort of gone right away. Right? It doesn't have that psychological vividness, but here's the key, right? That doesn't make a difference morally. Right? Those are different kinds of considerations. Go to the next slide. I pulled this quote because I thought it was sort of interesting. John Stuart Mill, kind of a famous philosopher, 19th century British philosopher, and in chapter 2 of his book, Utilitarianism, here's a quick passage, I just want to quickly read it, right? He claims, "The multiplication of happiness is the object of virtue. The occasions on which any person, except one in a thousand, has it in his power to do this on an extended scale. In other words, to be a public benefactor, are but exceptional. And on those occasions alone is he called on to consider public utility. In every other case, private utility, the interest or happiness of some few persons, is all he has to attend to." So this is John Stuart Mill writing in 1863, basically saying, what he's saying is, look, morally speaking, your job is to sort of pay attention to the people you're sort of closest to. Right? You pay attention to the circles that you're most immediately connected with, and you know what? That's all you have to do. Why? Because it's pretty much all you can do. It's pretty much all you can do, is what he's saying. Look, for one in a thousand, it's possible to extend your reach and help people beyond those who you're most immediately connected to. But that's really, really rare and exceptional. And so if you were, potentially from the moral point of view, unlucky enough to be such a public benefactor, right now, morally speaking, right, things just got more demanding for you. But no worries, 999 of you are not in that situation, so we're cool, right? But here's, I take Singer's point, right? This goes back to that quote from my offer at the start, right, where he says, look, changes to the world around us have changed our moral situation, right, in ways that are relevantly different from, basically every generation going back, thousands of years prior to, pick some point in the relevantly recent past. And so I think that's an interesting thing to see, right? That essentially what Singer's saying is, Mill was right, probably, in 1863. It's not true anymore. Just not true anymore. Next slide. Look, here's kind of more an obvious one that jumps out to people. I call it the numbers objection. I put take the S on because there's really two different objections packed in here, right? So you might note, first off, when we're talking about things like famines and stuff, we're not talking about one kid in a pond, right? We're talking about like a huge number. And it's not just us walking by, right? It's like, well, the whole world of affluent people walking by. And the challenge is, I'll be quick here, we can talk about this more, I realize it's almost 11, I want to get some time to chat. You know, adjust the pond case. Now imagine, it would be a gruesome image. You know, imagine the pond with like, just a vast sea of, you know, kind of desperate children. And imagine that there you are walking around, you know, with lots of people that you know walking by and not doing anything. I mean, Singer's answer would be, well, you know, first off, you might start yelling at the people, hey, you know what, you've got something to do here. But you'd also probably, you know, start pulling kids out and keep doing it until you're in danger of drowning yourself. And by the way, that was that modern version of the principle. So probably that's the true one all along. But, go ahead. Now look, this is the last slide, I think. If not, we'll leave it at that. This is a big objection. It's sort of a big objection in moral theory generally. The idea that what he's offering here is really demanding, right? That is, once we take this seriously, what it means is that we have a moral requirement where we might not have seen one before. And even if we're talking just about that weak version of just giving up trivial stuff to donate our resources towards people in great need, that could potentially ask a big change for some of us. Look, here's his answer. The way people do, in fact, judge has nothing to do with the validity of my conclusion. My conclusion follows from the principle I advanced earlier. Unless that principle is rejected, or the argument is shown to be unsound, I think a conclusion must stand, however strange it appears. This conclusion is one which we may be reluctant to face. I cannot see, though, why it should be regarded as a criticism of the position for which I have argued, rather than a criticism of our ordinary standards of behavior. So here's what he's saying, basically. Yeah, it's demanding insofar as it requires us to change. But that's not a problem for what I've argued. It's a problem for how you've understood the world. Anyway, that's the argument underlying that closing comment from November 8th. So I'll stop. We can talk now. Well, the challenge there is I don't know if we need that kind of certainty, right? I think with a pretty high probability, you know, if I go out to dinner with Kim to a restaurant we like, I think it's reasonable to think that the $50 we spent at the restaurant will not do as much good as sending the $50 to Doctors Without Borders. And as long as that's reasonable to think, then that should be good enough to at least get some sacrifice off the ground. But I agree, there's economic considerations that are deeper here that are important. You're right. I'll say what Singer says about this is that's a really good reason to simultaneously support helping the people who currently exist and supporting the organizations that are working towards helping people around family planning, right? Mm-hmm. So providing birth control and things like that. Yeah. I can say this very quickly. So just to explain the question. So Kant endorsed an ethic that was divorced from the outcomes of your actions. That is, he looked for a way to understand actions themselves as morally permissible or impermissible. And for Singer, the rightness or wrongness of our actions is directly tied to the expected outcome of those actions. So they're very much on opposite spectrums.
For you, though.